Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. As people know, this is the full moon day and the Pavarana day, the final day of the Vasa, the rains retreat. And the Vasa officially finishes at dawn tomorrow. The full moon is always the last day of the month. So the Vasa is completed officially, the season, tomorrow morning. Even though we did the Pavarana ceremony this morning, the month is sort of completed at dawn. And this evening we had a new Anagarika David's precept ceremony. And even though these forms, these rituals are very familiar to many of us. Taking refuges in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, the avowing of the eight precepts, these are very familiar and customary patterns to many, many of us. But occasions like this are useful, good opportunities to reflect on what these mean. In the early times of the Buddha Sasana, originally the Buddha always gave ordination just with an informal invitation. In the earliest of times, he would say, "Ehi Bhikkhu," just come, Bhikkhu. And in the very earliest of days, that was enough to constitute an ordination. And then as time went by and as the teaching spread and as others it became necessary, the Buddha couldn't do all of the ordinations. The teaching spread throughout that area of northern India, and so it became necessary to establish a form whereby people could officially take up the samana life, the ordained life. And originally, the whole of the ordination, and at say the second period of the sasana, was just taking the three refuges that constituted the ordination. If you had a robe and a bowl, all you had to do was say, "Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi," three times over, and that constituted the ordination. And still for the technically for novices also, that the taking of the three refuges is actually the ordination process, and then the naming of the precepts is more spelling out the details, but the actual commitment is taking refuge. That's the commitment to being a lay disciple, the commitment to being an anagarika, to being a siladhara, to being a samanera, a novice, to being a bhikkhu. You can reflect upon that taking of refuge in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha as in a broad sense encompassing the whole of one's quality of commitment. And that's an interesting thing to reflect on, regardless of one's stations in life, whether you're taking the five precepts or originally, even if you're going forth as a fully ordained monk or even nun in the earliest times. That's all it took, was to take the three refuges, and then the particular pattern of discipline that you followed was spelled out in more detail. But the main gesture of commitment is taking refuge. I find that's an interesting and helpful quality to reflect upon, so that the main principle then is looking to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha as the guiding principles of our lives, and then how we live as as a follower of the Buddha, as one who's committed to realizing Dhamma, then that we do according to our own disposition and choices, whether that's as an anagarika or as a monk or a nun or as a lay person, that the taking of the three refuges can be considered to be encompassing that gesture of commitment. I often like to think of these as setting the intention for what we aim to have at the center of our life. So one of the things I like to stress when people come to the monastery or on, like, say, Sunday mornings every week, on a Sunday here at Amaravati, there's a formal taking of the refuges and the precepts in the sala. And often I like to reflect that rather than, as you have in other religious traditions, like in Christianity, you have a baptism where you get baptized and you become officially a Christian, or if you want to become Jewish, you have to go through certain rituals and ceremonies to sort of do that. But once you've done it, then you're in. You've joined the club. In Buddha Dhamma, we don't really have the same kind of process. More, it's something that you remind yourself of continually. So, as a bhikkhu, we have our recitation of our rules, as Sila Dharal, the recitation of our rules. Samanera is the same. Every 2 weeks, we recite our rules. For the lay community, it's a little bit more informal, but often in Buddhist countries, people will come, whenever they come to the monastery, they'll take the refuges and precepts as a way of refreshing that intention. So I feel this is a very useful custom. And to me, it's significant that the Buddha established this form of recollecting the precepts and using the occasion of the upasita, the full moon and the new moon in particular, to bring these things to mind as a way of clarifying these central principles of our life. So he saw that we're all subject to distraction. We can set a good intention, we can have a noble aspiration, but that doesn't last. There is erosion. Our intentions, our good intentions, erode. We get distracted, we get taken up by the pressures of our work, our family life, pressures of society, the world around us, we get caught up. And so having a religious form, say like coming in on the lunar days or every week, every 2 weeks, to recollect, oh yes, this is what I'm about. These are the values that I see as being most important to my life. These are the principles that if I put these at the very center, if I establish these at the very center, then life goes much more harmoniously and easily, and it's much more helpful and productive to myself and others. If I build my life around Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, the refuge in the qualities of wisdom, the quality of wakefulness, appamada, that as represented by taking refuge in Buddha, the quality of realism, of truthfulness, of being in accord with Dhamma, with nature, and then refuge in Sangha. You can reflect on this in different ways, but Sangha literally means something like the unified assembly. The sang, the first part of the word, means together or compounded, like sankhara, sankata, dhamma, the compounded, the formed. So sangha is a unified assembly. So what enables us to unify as a group of human beings is the qualities of unselfishness, the qualities of virtue. So taking refuge in sangha is choosing to be unselfish, choosing to live respectfully and virtuously in relationship to other beings, in relationship to the world. So I find this is a very helpful way of reorienting, resetting our intention. You know, for the lay community, whenever coming to the monastery or living in the monastery, re-establishing this every every week on the half moons and the full and new moons, recollecting these qualities to say, yeah, this is what I want to use to set the direction in my life as a counterpoint to greed, hatred, and delusion. The habits of self-concern, of chasing after the liked, running away from the disliked, wandering around in our habits of self-view and deluded thinking. This is natural enough, it's ordinary enough for us as human beings, but to refresh that intention, to recognize that we get lost, to recognize that we've been distracted, that we've made mistakes, but that we can do better. We can recognize our mistakes as such and aim to do better in the future. And that's the central principle of training in Buddha Dhamma. Over and over again, the Buddha said to recognize our transgressions as such and to endeavor to do better, to purify our conduct. This is called development in the Buddha Sasana, in the Sasana. So this is, I feel, a very realistic and helpful teaching, and that what's behind taking the precepts. So Anagarika David has made a formal commitment for a year, but also every 2 weeks when we have the Patimokkha day, the new moon, the full moon days, then he will formally reaffirm those precepts, just as the Bhikkhu Sangha and Siladhara, the Samaniras, recite our rules to reaffirm that structure of training. But in that also is that the recognition of having made mistakes. So beginning before our recitation, we have a formal acknowledgement of our transgressions, the different categories of offenses that we have as monastics, and then to recognize those, to acknowledge those, and then as a small ritual of forgiveness that we do. So to presume that we're never going to make mistakes is one extreme, and to feel that our mistakes are unforgivable, that are so bad they can never be erased, that's the other extreme. But the middle way, as espoused by the Buddha, is just this recognizing that yes, we lose it. We get distracted, we get caught up by fear, by aversion, by desire, by conceit and attachment to views and biases of various kinds. That happens. That's even up to arahantship. We are subject to mistakes, to errors. And so to recognize that and to acknowledge that and to make efforts to do better in the future, that is the path of development. That's what is called development in the Buddha Sasana. So in this respect, when we observe the Upasatha, when we have these full moon days and new moon days, the half moons as well, it's an opportunity to bring those central qualities to mind. Whenever we take refuge, it's easy for the mouth to just say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. We've done it so many times, the mind drifts off, and worrying about that feeling in our knee, or planning the rest of the evening, or worrying about that funny noise in your car when you were driving here. But we carry out these rituals not just because it's a custom that is expected, but in order to train ourselves, in order to benefit our own lives. And so it's really most useful and helpful to be truly sincere, to be paying attention to what we're doing when we bow, when we chant the words, and to say this is setting the intention to be guided by wisdom, by truth, by realism, and by virtue. That is the intention. To let go of the past, to set the intention for the future, and to do the best we can. And when we set things up in that way, then we are, in a sense, making the best use we can of our resources, the the capacities that we have to develop the path, to develop sila, samadhi, panya. And when we think about the different elements of the path or elements of the training, say in sila, David is just taken on in a formal way the eight precepts, these sets of commitments, stipulations to not take the life of any living creature, no more killing off of green fly or mosquitoes, to not take anything that's not given, to refrain from any kind of intentional sexual activity, to refrain from lying, also false and harmful speech, abusive speech, to refrain from intoxicants, to refrain from eating at inappropriate times, any time between midday and dawn of the next day is the vikala, the inappropriate times. To refrain from entertainment, beautification, adornment, no more cartwheels, frisbee is off, no more earrings, no trips to the movies, that's all off the menu, at least for the next year. And to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place so that you can't, there's no sex, no dinner, no movies, no fun, no frisbee. And so, like, even if life gets really boring and really tedious, the eighth precept is the one that puts the, it closes the door on just sleeping your way through the whole thing. And I remember years ago at Chithurst back in the early 80s, someone was making a comment about the demanding nature of the routine and how the people were really the days were very full and it was very demanding and rigorous routine and that it was hard to get enough rest. And I remember one particularly dedicated anagarika saying, venerable, if you really put your mind to it, you can get 14 hours of sleep a day in here. I won't mention any names, but for 14 hours a day, he says, yes, you have to really work at it. as soon as the breakfast meeting's over, just straight up to your room, get 20 minutes before the work period begins. So you can, if you want to, have a very slothful, you could sleep through 2/3 of your anagarika year if you tried. But the point of the eighth precept is to encourage wakefulness, to encourage that not using sleep and unconsciousness as a way of avoiding dukkha. So the eight precepts we can see as closing the door upon the familiar avenues of distraction, nibbling on snacks, eating what we like when we like, sexual activity, the kind of hours and days and weeks we can spend caught up in concern about relationships, engaging with others in that way, the different ways that we can spend our time through distraction, through unskillful kinds of behavior. So it's gently and firmly closing the door on all of those avenues of distraction, also the areas where we create heavy karma, so that refraining from making bad karma through speech, through taking the life of other beings, through taking what's not given. So we are dampening the capacity to create heavy karma through these commitments, and dampening the capacity to be distracted, closing the door on the various familiar avenues of distraction. So when we look at the precepts in that way, there can be an awful lot of what we're not doing, and a lot of restraint, and it can seem like a lot of limitation, to refrain from this, refrain from that, and so it can seem like a very tight set of restrictions. And when we talk about the eight precepts and the monastic form, we use the English word renunciation or renunciate form, But the Pali word nikama doesn't carry quite the same connotations as renunciation, because in English the word renunciation tends to imply a state of lack or limitation. And just when we look at these on paper, we describe this, it can seem that way. That we're training ourselves to go without things that we would really prefer to have, or that would be really much more desirable or good, but we're just gritting our teeth and muscling our way through and managing to get along without them. But it's helpful to consider the precepts and the renunciate life from a very different point of view, because nikamma is one of the paramitas. It's a brightness of our being. It's a great strength. It's not just a capacity to grit our teeth and bear with the unpleasant or feelings of frustration. It's not that at all, in fact. And nekama is more to do with a complete simplicity of heart, a quality of independence, a freedom from reliance, that it's that quality of spaciousness and ease where we don't need anything. Nekama is a lack of neediness, in a way. It's that strength of heart that is not depend on particular comfortable or desired conditions. Now, there's a particular sutta in the Anguttara, I believe it's in the Book of the Eights, called the Upposita Sutta. And it describes very interestingly the way that the Buddha formulated the eight precepts. And he had already had the idea of seeing that different spiritual groups had ways of observing, gathering together and using a particular day of the week as a sort of special day for spiritual observance, and using the lunar quarters for that. And he considered, well, what would be good? This would be a good thing for us to do with our community. And so how should we do that? How should we gather together for the lunar days, and what would be useful for us to do? So initially the community would gather, and then first of all the monastics would just sit there and not say anything, would just meditate, quote, like dumb pigs, unquote, as the Buddha put it. Said, no, don't just sit there and meditate. This is a time for gathering, for sharing the Dhamma, so it's a good opportunity to give teachings and for people to reflect upon the verbal aspect of Dhamma, as well as the bhavana, the meditation. So there was that aspect of gathering together, listening to Dhamma teachings. But in the Upposita Sutta, this particular teaching, he describes how he came up with the formula of the eight precepts. And this is what really gives it a different tone to the idea of renunciation as a state of lack, or the eight precepts as a system of limitation. Because what he says is, all of their lives, the enlightened ones, the arahants, do not deliberately take the life of any living creature. Wouldn't it be a good thing for the lay community, for one day a week, for them to undertake the same standard, to similarly refrain from taking the life of living creatures? And in that way, they will live as the arahants do, and that will be for their long-lasting welfare and happiness. And so then with the second precept, all their lives, arahants never take anything which is not given to them. Wouldn't it be a good thing for the lay community if one day a week they similarly undertook this standard of not taking anything that is not given to them? And in that way, they would live as the arahants do, and that would be for their long-lasting welfare and happiness. Similarly with all the other precepts, that arahants refrain from sexual activity, they refrain from false, harmful, abusive speech, they refrain from intoxicants, they only eat in one part of the day, they refrain from entertainment, beautification, adornment, and they use a low plain sleeping place for resting. They refrain from high and luxurious sleeping places. So that the Buddha is taking as this the origin, or is describing the origin of the eight precepts as the pure heart, that if the heart is totally freed from greed, hatred and delusion, from bias, from these unskillful habits, then this is our natural disposition. If the heart is free from greed, hatred and delusion, this is how it's disposed. It's incapable of harming another creature out of any intentional action. Incapable of taking anything that's not given. Incapable of interest in sexual activity. Incapable of lying, of harsh or abusive false speech. Totally uninterested in distraction through intoxication. Absolutely unappealing to be unmindful. No interest in food other than to keep the body fueled and to be able to sustain life and to maintain comfort and well-being. Utterly uninterested in distractions and beautification. And uninterested in spending more than necessary time, sleeping and whiling away the hours in a state of unconsciousness. So this puts a very different slant on the eight precepts. And what it's pointing to is that the eight precepts are drawing upon that purest quality of our own being. In a way, it's if we are guided by the Dhamma in its purest sense, we're guided by an awakening to the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unconditioned. Then this is... If that is awakened to, if we recognize that dimension of our own being and know that directly, then this is how we will behave. This is our natural disposition. So there's no restraint. An arahant is not having to hold back violent impulses. It's not having to restrain the urge to steal or to swear or to sleep the day away. It's not arising. There's no interest there. It's not a limitation. It's an expression of a plenitude of being, the puna dhamma, the fullness of being that is the disposition. Is the in a way when the heart is freed from greed, hatred, and delusion, there is that quality of fullness, isn't there? The sense of not needing anything. Everything is fine. Everything is good just as it is. There's nothing missing and nothing in excess, as it said. So this is a good way to reflect on the eight precepts. And some of the eight precepts are what are called natural precepts. Say that the five precepts that are described for general lay conduct, these are what are called the natural precepts. These are what the Buddha said are intrinsic in the human condition, that if we wish to be living as a real human being, to qualify for the human realm, then this is how we live. And these are called natural sila. So refraining from taking life, refraining from stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false, harmful speech, and then refraining from intoxicants, and particularly those first four. The first four of the five are outlined over and over again as intrinsic to the human condition. That if we act on those, if we take life, or if we take what's not given, if we steal or we lie or so forth, then there's necessarily a negative karmic result to that. So these are sometimes called the moral precepts. And then the other kind of sila is called the ascribed sila, or it's a sila that's adopted by choice, by convention. So that so to eat dinner, to have supper in the evening, is not considered immoral. It's not, there's no intrinsic negative karma to wearing earrings or eating supper. This is a precept that is taken on by choice, by social convention, or by choice to simplify life. So these are called renunciant precepts, or the precepts taken on by adoption, or being ascribed a value as precepts by a choice. So this would be the third precept, changing from refraining from sexual misconduct to celibacy. And then the last three precepts are not eating in the evening, refraining from music and dancing and frisbee and cartwheels and so forth. And then the eighth precept about refraining from high and luxurious sleeping places. So those last three are all what are called renunciant precepts. And then the third one, changing to celibacy, that's a renunciant precept. Now when we can consider the eight precepts and the anagarika form, in a way is the basic skeleton of the renunciate life. And when we think of it in terms of the expression of the pure heart, the expression of this is how an enlightened being would live. And this is where the Buddha derived the standards of the eight precepts are from the conduct of enlightened ones. Then what we're doing is, when we adopt the behavior, by adopting the external form, it helps us to be in accord with that fundamental quality of our own being. So when we take on the precept of refraining from killing things or refraining from lying, we are, by adopting that behavior, we can't just cut off the defilements. You don't just suddenly erase impulses towards violence or greed or sexual desire or dishonesty and so forth. It doesn't just erase the impulse or the underlying tendency. But what we're doing when we take those precepts is it's helping us to recollect, oh, there is a part of me inside me, and there's a part of my nature, of this heart, which is completely incapable of violence. There's part of the me, there's an aspect of this heart which is really incapable of lying, of deceiving. And so that taking the precept as the external form helps us to, in a way, open up the track, open up the pathway to that aspect of our being, which is, in a sense, the source of that. It's opening up the doorway to that inner quality that is completely honest, that's completely non-violent, that is incapable of deception. And so by taking on the external form, we're encouraging ourselves to draw upon that noble, that pure aspect of our own heart, to nurture it, to encourage it, to bring it forth and to cherish it. So by taking on the precepts and reminding ourselves of the precepts, it's not something that's being imposed from outside. It's not just, oh, this is what it says in the book, so I have to do this. Or this is what the teacher says, and I trust the teacher, so I should do it. Holding it as if it was something coming from outside, but I find it's far more skillful and helpful to see, no, this is already what drew me to this place originally. What drew us here to being in a monastery, to even just for an evening, whether it's for an evening or a day or a week or a year or a lifetime. What drew us here is that resonance of the qualities embodied in the monastery and the values of simplicity, of sanctuary, of purity of heart, that resonates with something within us that says, yes, I want to be around people who are completely non-violent. I love to be around people who are honest, who everyone's going to try and speak to you in an honest and clear and open way. No one's going to steal anything of mine. This is great. So we're drawing upon that nature, that disposition of our own heart, and doing what we can to create the conditions whereby that can flourish, that can be nurtured, can blossom, and so that those values, those qualities, then are brought forth, that which is obstructing them, the underlying tendencies of conceit, of fear, of aversion, of greed, and so forth. Those are no longer being fed, those can fade and fall away, and that which feeds them, that which nourishes them, the qualities of mindfulness, of virtue, of concentration, of wisdom, the things that feed those wholesome qualities, they're maintained in being, they're brought into being and maintained, so that those qualities of harmlessness, those qualities of honesty, those qualities of respectfulness and simplicity, they are enabled, they're encouraged to permeate our being more and more fully and completely through the various different levels of development. Now, Lumpur's talked a lot about the first three fetters and the breakthrough that comes with the shedding, the letting go of those first three fetters of self-view, of attachment to conventions, to rules and rituals, observances, silapata paramasa, attachment to doubt, being caught up in doubt. So one way of characterizing that breakthrough is, in a sense, nurturing these qualities of purity of heart, and the qualities of virtue, the qualities of concentration, the qualities of wisdom, nurturing those to the point where they are, in a way, like putting a plant in the ground or putting a tree in the ground, where you know the tree is going to make it on its own. You don't have to nurse it and nurture it anymore. It's off and running, and it'll look after itself from now on. It's like it's up and running. It's on its own, and so that irreversibility of stream entry, of the breakthrough, is that is talking about that degree of penetration of our being, of that insight, so that we can no longer forget it completely. We can no longer unsee it. Once you've learned to ride a bicycle, you can't unlearn it. The system, once you know how to do it, once the body has learned how to do it, it can't unlearn it. And so that we use the formal adoption of the precepts, as the eight precepts, the ten precepts, or the higher ordinations, as a way of creating an external form, using the external forms of training and of commitment to create the optimal conditions whereby those inner qualities can be developed. That's what it's for. That's what they're for. And so that when we take those precepts on, rather than thinking of them as just a set of behaviors that we acquire or sort of rules and forms that we follow because this is an aspect of the details of the tradition, it's far more helpful, far more skillful to me, I feel it's more helpful in terms of spiritual training to see that these are an external manifestation in the realm of behavior of the pure heart. They're living on alms, living on whatever is offered freely by the abundance and generosity of the universe, living harmlessly, living honestly. We have these as formal rules, and in the monks and nuns' lives, spelled out in intricate detail over many, many pages, hundreds of pages, thousands of pages. But essentially, these are all boiling down to the disposition of the pure heart and helping us to tap into that, to live from that, and to nurture that for our own benefit and for the benefit of all those around us. Now, I was saying at the beginning how with the Buddha's approach towards spiritual training, we recognize our capacity to get lost, to make mistakes. And the Pavarana day, as I mentioned just before the meal time in the sala, to those of us who were there, the Pavarana means the invitation. It's an open invitation to that all of the monastic community make to each other to say, please, I make the invitation to the Sangha, Sangham Bhante Pavare Mi. I invite the Sangha. Whatever I have done by body, speech or mind that has been harmful or destructive and difficult for you, please, I ask for, out of compassion, please let me know about that. And please, please tell me, I ask for your feedback. And so this is a beautiful gesture. And again, it, like reciting the refuges, it can be just the mouth doing the verbals while the mind wanders off somewhere else. So it's not something we're really paying attention to. But just like this morning when we were having the ceremony with the monks, the acoustics in the center of the hall are not terribly brilliant. And so Lumpur asked, you know, one of the monks, could you speak up? I can't hear you. Even though he's heard this formula. Yeah, everyone says the same formula. He's heard this formula many, many times over. He says, you're making an invitation. You're inviting feedback from the Sangha. So please speak up. I can't hear you. So I thought that was a very interesting and beautiful gesture. So even though you know what's being said, you know what? You could say, yes, it's just a formulaic thing. It's just a ritual. But I was quite touched by Lumpur saying, speak up, I can't hear you. You're making an invitation. I need to hear you. So it needs to be sincere. Now this is as a little aside, an etymological aside. The word sincere comes from Latin, and it literally means without wax. Without wax. You might think that's a very odd meaning. But it's a term used by sculptors. So when you are doing making a sculpture out of stone, if you made a mistake with your chisel, or you had the stone was flawed, or there was a crack in it, or you made an error with the way you were cutting the stone, and there was a scratch or a gouge, to make sure that the statue looked perfect, you would fill up the crack or the flaw, the mistake, with wax. And if something is sine sera, without wax, it meant it's flawless on its own. So to be sincere is to not be hiding your flaws, to be sort of fully with what's going on, and to be wholehearted. So in that gesture of pavarana, there's a humility there. There's a recognition of we make mistakes. All the things that we say and do, no matter our intention might be of the very best, we might be feeling that we are being perfectly mindful and kind and compassionate and wise and accurate in all the things that we've said and done. But what this ceremony and also in relationship to it, the asking for forgiveness ceremony similarly does is it recognizes even with the best of intentions, even with someone who's completely enlightened, an enlightened being, still says and does things that can be upsetting to others. With no unskillful intention whatsoever, still we are capable of annoying and upsetting or causing hurt to each other. And so that gesture of pavarana is a way of saying, please let me know. Please tell me if there's something that I'm doing, something that I'm saying, the way I'm acting, or something that I have done that has been hurtful. Please let me know, because then I can pay attention to that. I can change my conduct. I can change the way I do things and make amends and aim to do better in the future. So that I feel that's a tremendously skillful ceremony. Again, it's a ritual. It's a ceremony, but it embodies a psychological pattern or a structure that we can use, so that even if you're in a monastery where someone, say the teacher, is known as being an arahant or is widely regarded as such, it's not like you say, the Ajahn doesn't have to say please forgive me because the Ajahn's totally enlightened. Even so, the teacher will still say, I forgive you and please forgive me also. It's not that anybody is saying, oh, I'm beyond that, or that you couldn't possibly be offended by me because I'm always right. I feel it's a tremendously skillful thing that it's recognizing what the basis of communal life is, and living harmoniously as a community is not just having good intentions, but also recognizing that our version of reality might not be the same as everybody else's version of reality, and that what we feel might be true and good might be something that's painful or difficult or really irritating to the person sitting next to us. So it's a gesture of humility, a gesture of kindness, and a readiness to change. Oftentimes people ask the question, how do you see delusion? You know, greed and hatred are pretty vivid. You know, when the mind is filled with greed and desire, we can see that. It's highlighted very clear. I want that. Or hatred, aversion. We can see that. It's like underlined in red three times. Really sharp. Like greed is got sharp edges. It's very distinct when the mind is averse, irritated. I hate that. I don't like that. This is wrong. But delusion, people often say, well, how do you see delusion? Because you know, the mind's deluded, so how can it know it's deluded? And this is a very good question. It gets asked many, many times. And some years ago, somebody asked me this question, and I hadn't really thought about it in those terms before, but what popped out of my mouth was, well, this is where spiritual friendship comes in. Because it's true, it's hard to see delusion because the very means whereby we would see it is obstructed to us. We're not seeing clearly, therefore we can't tell that we're deluded. It's hard to see delusion because the way in which we would see it is cloudy, is blurry, is not clear. So spiritual friendship, our feedback from our friends, from our spiritual companions, our like-minded people that we share our life with, that's in a way the most helpful resource for seeing delusion is the people who live with us, the people that we have common goals, common understanding with, they can point out things that we can't see for ourselves, and that they can bring things up for question or can politely let us know, do you realize the effect that you have when you walk like that, or you talk like that, or do you realize that seems very odd, that you do things in such and such a way? Are you aware of that? And so that this quality of this tradition of Pavarana and the quality of openness that it offers, saying, please let me know, there's an invitation. It's a way of recognizing that we can all use help. We benefit from the care and skillful attention, the spiritual friendship of others. And in particular, this from my perspective, it's often in this area of delusion. That can be most helpful. It's obviously not the only way, but in particular, it can be the feedback from our friends that help us to see things that we can't see for ourselves, because you know the way that we perceive the world becomes so habitual. It's difficult to challenge our own outlook, our own perspectives, our own opinions, to see them in an objective way, because we get so habituated to our own habits of seeing and thinking. Our own conditioning is completely normal and natural enough. But also I should say that when we make the Pavarana, it's not like people come with a whole list of a kind of catalogue of wrongs that you've been collecting over the weeks and months for everyone that you live with. It's not it doesn't work like that. But it's more of a gesture of invitation, and also a reminding yourself to be open, to the feedback from others about your own conduct, and that sometimes it can be hard for us to, we can be very sure of our own actions or be very defensive. But even having a formality of saying I'm open to feedback from others, just the seeing the resistance that there might be within us, like, I don't want to hear anything from anyone, and you can see someone sort of making a beeline for you, oh no, here it comes. I can feel some feedback about to arrive. Yeah. And you suddenly want to look very busy on the way to something else. But just to use, we can use that, the ceremony in this occasion of a formal invitation for feedback like this, just to even notice, like, wow, I really don't want to hear that. I really don't want to get any feedback from others. Look at that, that's interesting. Just noticing that quality of resistance within ourselves. So even that amount illumination on our habits can be very, very helpful. Yeah, even that, the resistance to getting feedback or seeing how others, or receiving how others see things. So for the monastic community, I'm not sure how it's practiced here at Amaravati, but the way we would do things at Abhayagiri, and I find is a helpful way of working with this, is usually what would happen would be that people would make the invitation, and then if there is anything that people want to bring up over the next few days, then they would take a quiet moment and say, oh, Venerable, is this... You got a moment, there's something I'd like to mention. And usually there might be like one or two things that people bring up with one or two people, but it's not, as I said, it's not like everyone's carrying around a whole kind of book of complaints about each other. But usually it's just over the next few days finding a convenient, quiet moment to consider like what you want to, or to bring something up with somebody that you feel might be helpful. And the Buddha gave a set of criteria, and he spoke about it in various ways, but there's a set of criteria that he encouraged if you want to give feedback to others, one of which is to speak out of loving kindness rather than out of judgmentalism and and pig-headedness or aversion. So speaking from a place of loving kindness, choosing the right time and place in order to bring something up, so you don't sort of do it in the middle of the sala with 20 other people hovering around. You choose a quiet time, a quiet place, a suitable moment. You ask permission, first of all, say, is it possible to bring something up? And if they say no, then okay, leave it alone. To speak according to the facts, to not just speak out of hearsay or supposition or your own guesswork, but also to be speaking about things as far as you know from factual reality. And then the last consideration, there's a few different ways of looking at it, but the last major consideration is you need to be free of the same fault yourself. That's the kicker. So just to consider those different points is very, very helpful. And so I know for myself, sometimes when I've lived with people, that I've felt very irritated by certain actions. And there's one years ago, when I lived at a branch monastery, I had a lot of critical thoughts about the abbot and the way he did certain things and exercised his authority in various ways. It was really upsetting and annoying. And I was quite a bit junior to him, but also I could see that I had this very self-righteous, critical, like, how dare he? That's outrageous. He shouldn't do that. That's not right. Right. And so I considered these criteria, and I thought, I better not say anything yet. I have to wait until I'm less self-righteous and heated and annoyed. And so even though I knew I was right, I had, you know, I had the, you know, dates and places and could quote certain things that had been said. I had all the evidence, all the backup, you know, all the that was there. But I could see that I was coming from a critical, negative, judgmental place. And so I decided just to wait until that shifted. And it turned out to be that I waited for a couple of years. It was 2 years later that I actually brought up the issues. And it was what I found was that when it was not for me, when it wasn't that I want your behavior to change so that my world will be more comfortable and tidy, but it shifted. I'm not sure exactly how, but somewhere along the line it shifted when it was more a point, and it more came from a sense of, poor guy, he keeps creating these collisions and difficulties, and this happens everywhere he goes. Poor guy, you know, really, somebody really ought to say something just to help him to see what he's doing and how he seems to create these situations over and over again. And so once I realized, oh, it's not for me, it's for him and for the greater benefit, then I thought, okay, well, now that my attitude has shifted, I'll just wait for the right moment. And it turned out that it was actually here at Amaravati, where neither of us were living at that time. It wasn't our either of our monastery. And it was a completely sort of impromptu moment. And it was just a very easy and sort of friendly conversation we were having. And somehow the conversation moved around to certain aspects of conflict or dealing with obstruction. And suddenly I realized, oh, this is the moment. This is the moment. And so I said, well, actually, Ajahn, if I might mention something. And then brought up a couple of incidents that fitted in with what he was saying. He said, oh, really? Is that what I do? Gee, is that how it comes across? I don't mean to be that way at all. Is that how it comes over? Oh dear, I never realized that. And it was because I was not coming from a place of aversion or self-righteousness or you should be different or you shouldn't be doing that, but it was coming from a genuine place of friendliness. I found that as the conversation went on, I was able to say far more, go into far more detail, and even things I never even fantasized saying to him that I thought, well, I could never say that. Well, that would be way too difficult. No, he'd never be able to buy that. But then as the conversation went on, I thought, well, why not just let him hear the whole of the story, you know, all of the picture. And it was the most wonderful and useful exchange. It was really very, very, very helpful. And but yet it took a couple of years to wait for my own attitude to have come around and to have cooled down, and also just to wait for the right moment, that there was a quality of friendliness and respectfulness and ease. It was a very good lesson for myself. And so, not that you have to wait a couple of years to bring things up with each other, with others. But just that was a particularly striking incident in my own experience, and how worth it was. That had a very good effect in the long term, and I was surprised, marvelled at the good effect that did have. So the Buddha encourages being thoughtful and mindful about how we bring things up with others, and so these are some criteria to bring to mind and to consider, you know, and to have that providing some context to help to inform us as to what to bring up, when to bring up, how to bring it up, and who's it for? Is it for me? Is it or is it for the other person, or for the for the benefit of all. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Please take whatever is useful, and whatever is not, please leave aside.
Andamayam dhamma o arigata satukaram dhamma se.